Our lives are filled with waiting. Waiting for the traffic light to turn green. Waiting for the coffee to finish brewing. Waiting for quitting time at work. Waiting for the preacher to get to the point in the sermon. Waiting for our future spouse to finally show up in our life. Waiting for the web page to refresh. Waiting in line at the grocery store. Waiting for the next season of your favorite television show to be released on Netflix so you can binge it. Waiting in the waiting room in the doctor's office so that you can then wait in the exam room for the doctor to show up. Waiting for someone to respond to one of the hundreds of job apps that you submitted. Waiting, waiting, and waiting. We would think that we would be better at waiting because of all of the practice we get. Psalm 130, verse 5, it says, I wait for the Lord, my whole being waits, and in his word I put my hope. Waiting for the Lord is an important spiritual discipline for us to practice. And there's a misconception about waiting for the Lord. Some think waiting for the Lord is inactivity, that it's literally sitting and waiting, doing nothing until the sky opens up and begins showering miracles upon you. Instead, waiting for the Lord is not that at all. Waiting for the Lord is actively submitting myself to his lordship, doing what he wants me to do, the way he wants me to do it, when he wants me to do it. That's waiting for the Lord. We're continuing our Bible study this morning through the books of Samuel. We finished the book of 1 Samuel last time, and we got into the first chapter of 2 Samuel. We'll be getting into the thick of 2 Samuel today. We're actually going to cover four chapters. I know some of you find that hard to believe, but it is the intent, and I believe that we'll do that. If it takes us all day, we're going to do that. No, it won't hopefully be nearly that painful. But the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, you might remember, are really two parts of a single book. 2 Samuel picks up right where 1 Samuel leaves off. By way of review, to kind of set the moment in time where we're at. To get out from under the relentless pressure of King Saul hunting to kill David, he and his men, they moved into Philistine territory under the care of the Philistine king Achish, who then gave them the Philistine city of Ziklag in order to live. And when the Philistines then gathered their forces for this massive war against Israel, King Achish told David that he expected him and his men to fight alongside the Philistines against Israel. When the other Philistine leaders saw David and his men as part of their army, though, they were not happy. They demanded that David and his men be sent away. They didn't trust David. So David and his men were sent back to Ziklag while the Philistines marched into war against Israel. Well, the battle went badly for Israel. The Philistines decimated them, inflicting heavy losses. King Saul and three of his sons lost their lives that day, including David's beloved friend Jonathan. David wept and mourned deeply when he learned of the outcome of the battle. The first chapter of 2 Samuel ends with a beautiful, heartfelt lament that David wrote for Saul and Jonathan. We looked at that last time. Well, with the death of King Saul, the nation of Israel found itself facing an uncertain future. What will happen to this fledgling monarchy with the passing of their first king, Saul? Will this loosely held together nation of the 12 tribes survive that? Who's going to succeed Saul as king? Well, we have the benefit of hindsight, knowing that David will eventually become the next king. But the people who were living in that moment, they're facing a lot of uncertainties. And as we'll see, the transition to David being king is not smooth. There will be years of civil war, betrayals, people vying for power, backdoor deals, assassinations. What an important observation that will come out of these stories is this: the Lord is faithful to keep his promises and to fulfill his will, even through and in spite of the struggles and the chaos of humanity's self-will. Our life can look like a chaotic mess. Things are not working out the way we hoped they would. Tragedy and heartbreak and disappointment crowding into every crevice of our life. Roadblocks, detours, side roads. We wonder how the Lord's will ever gets accomplished in our life. The mechanics of how the sovereignty of God works while allowing human beings the freedom to make meaningful choices is a mystery, operating at a level that's far beyond our reasoning. We can't always see God's hand in the details of the journey while we're in the middle of it. But when we get to the destination, we look back and we see how the Lord was at work in all of it, all along the way. We live by faith, trusting in the Lord throughout the journey of our life, knowing that in all things he works for the good of those who love him and have been called according to his purpose. Romans 8:28. Well, let's flip over to 2 Samuel chapter 2. With Saul now dead, it would have been an opportune time for David to return to Israel and assert himself as king. He doesn't do that, though. Instead, he waits and seeks the Lord about what he should do and when and how. Beginning in first verse of 2 Samuel 2, it says, "In the course of time, David inquired of the Lord, 'Shall I go up to one of the towns of Judah?' he asked. And the Lord said, 'Go up.' David asked, 'Where shall I go?' 'To Hebron,' the Lord answered. So David went up there with his two wives, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. David also took the men who were with him, each with his family, and they settled in Hebron and its towns. Then the men of Judah came to Hebron, and there they anointed David king over the tribe of Judah." It says, in the course of time, David inquired of the Lord. Even though David knows that the Lord has chosen him to be the next king, he doesn't assume that he knows how it's supposed to be accomplished. Instead, he's seeking the Lord and he's waiting for his direction. The Lord tells David it's time for him to move back into Israel, to the territory of David's native tribe of Judah, to the city of Hebron. Then, not long after David and his men have settled in Hebron, it says the leaders of the tribe of Judah, they come and they anoint David, formally establishing him as their king. Well, things look to be going smooth as butter. The people of Judah have embraced David as their king with open arms. David becoming king over the rest of Israel is not going to go as smoothly, though. If we skip down to verse 8, it says, "Meanwhile," and that word tips us off that things are going to be complicated. It says, "Meanwhile, Abner, son of Ner, the commander of Saul's army, had taken Ish-bosheth, son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim. He made him king over Gilead, Asheri, and Jezreel, and also over Ephraim, Benjamin, and all Israel." Following Saul's death, Abner, a cousin of Saul and the commander of the army, he stepped in to provide leadership for the country in Saul's absence. Abner is now the person with the power, and he's the one calling the shots. And Abner has his own ideas about who should succeed Saul as king. Saul had four sons. Three of them have been killed in the battle against the Philistines. Saul's fourth son, Ish-bosheth, had not participated in the battle against the Philistines. Even though he was certainly old enough to do so, he is about 40 years old at this point in his life. But as the story unfolds, we learn that Ishbosheth was a coward. He's weak, easily manipulated, and bullied. The name Ishbosheth means man of shame, which is a name that he was given following his untimely death, and it gives us insight into him. Ishbosheth was the perfect candidate for Abner to use as a puppet king to serve his purposes. Abner declares Ishbosheth king over all Israel. So suddenly, what had been a single kingdom under Saul is now divided. David is the king over the tribe of Judah, and the son of Saul, Ishbosheth, is the king over the rest of Israel. Well, as you might expect, hostilities will soon arise between these two kingdoms within the kingdom. And verse 12 begins to tell the story of how the war between the two sides began. In verse 12, it says, Abner, son of Ner, together with the men of Ishbosheth, son of Saul, left Mahanaim and went to Gibeon. Joab, son of Zeruiah, and David's men went out and met them at the pool of Gibeon. One group sat down on one side of the pool and one group on the other side. So Abner led his army south down to Gibeon, which was near the border of Judah. Joab, the commander of David's army, brought his men up from the north to Gibeon. And at a place known as the Pool of Gibeon, these two commanders and their armies face each other. Well, tension, as you can imagine, is very thick in the air. These two armies are both looking for a fight. Abner, he proposes to Joab that they have a little contest between some of their young men, a little hand-to-hand combat for entertainment. And this is when things quickly disintegrate. Then Abner said to Joab, let's have some of the young men get up and fight hand-to-hand in front of us. All right, let them do it, Joab said. So they stood up and were counted off, 12 men for Benjamin and Ishbosheth, son of Saul, and 12 for David. Then each man grabbed his opponent by the head and thrust his dagger into his opponent's side, and they fell down together. So that place in Gibeon was called Helkath Hazurim, which means field of daggers. So we see this very strange contest that they have. 12 on each side, one on one, grab each other, and they die. Big surprise for all of us. Well, Abner and Joab, they get what they want. It says the battle that day was very fierce, and Abner and the Israelites were defeated by David's men. A huge battle erupts. Brings to mind Proverbs 30:33, where it says, for as churning cream produces butter, and as twisting the nose produces blood, so stirring up anger produces strife or leads to a fight. They've churned lots of butter here today. Before the fighting was over, almost 400 men will lose their lives in this battle that day. The war between these two factions will continue for months. By way of application, we can be so convinced that our side is right and the other guy is wrong. We can talk ourselves into thinking that fighting for what we believe is right is the right thing to do. Unfortunately, we often don't count the cost of the fight until it's too late. As followers of Jesus, we're supposed to be peacemakers, not warmongers. Romans 12:14, it says, bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse. Then down to verse 17 of that same chapter, it says, do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Verse 21, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. And you know, the first place where we need to begin to adopt those attitudes and practice these things is in our personal relationships with our spouse, our children, our friends, our coworkers, our neighbors, the other drivers on the freeway. Bless those who persecute. Bless and do not curse. Do not repay evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. Live at peace. Don't be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Boy, what a challenge that is. Well, if we skip to chapter 3, as this war dragged on, Ishbosheth grew increasingly threatened by Abner, believing that he had designs to take the throne of Israel for himself. Ishbosheth believed Abner was sleeping with one of his father Saul's concubines, which he interpreted as Abner vying for the throne. He confronted Abner about it, and it made Abner very mad. He was offended, he said, that Ishbosheth would accuse him of such a thing after all that he had done for Saul and his family, and for Ishbosheth in particular, setting him up with the kingship. Abner told Ishbosheth that he was now going to transfer the kingdom of Israel to David. And he immediately set about doing exactly that. He sent messengers to David informing him of his intentions and requesting a meeting to formalize an agreement between the two sides. Verse 17 of that chapter says, Abner conferred with the elders of Israel and said, "For some time you have wanted to make David your king. Now do it. For the Lord promised David, 'By my servant David, I will rescue my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and from the hand of all their enemies.'" This is interesting. Abner and others have known for quite some time that the Lord had chosen David to be the king. People in Israel have wanted David to be their king. But Abner has done everything that he can up to this point to prevent that from happening. Now, he's going to go along with that. Abner also spoke to the Benjamites in person. Then he went to Hebron to tell David everything that Israel and the whole tribe of Benjamin wanted to do. When Abner, who had 20 men with him, came to David at Hebron, David prepared a feast for him and his men. Then Abner said to David, "Let me go at once and assemble all Israel for my lord the king, so that they may make a covenant with you and that you may rule over all that your heart desires." So David sent Abner away and he went in peace. Well, it appears that peace is finally going to come and all of Israel will be united with David as their king. The promise that the Lord had made to David that he would be the king is going to finally be a reality. Well, not so fast. You see, there are still people on the planet. And where there are people, there's trouble. Right after Abner left his meeting with David, Joab, the commander of David's army, arrived back in town from a military operation. And he was told that Abner had just left, that he had been here meeting with David. Joab couldn't believe that David had let Abner go. He immediately goes to David and he demands to know why David didn't kill him on the spot. He says, "What were you thinking, David? You should have killed him while you had a chance. You know he can't be trusted. You know he came here just to deceive you and to spy on us." Well, behind David's back, Joab then sent a message to Abner to come back to town for a private meeting, perhaps to discuss details of the transfer of power, blah, blah, blah. Joab then got Abner alone and he murdered him. Out of revenge for Abner having killed Joab's brother, Asahel, in that first battle they had at the Pool of Gibeon. We didn't look at that story this morning, but Abner had done everything reasonably expected of him that day to avoid killing Joab's brother, Asahel. Asahel's own determined recklessness is what got him killed. If it can be said, Abner's killing of Asahel had been justified and in large part unintentional. Joab's killing of Abner, though, was cold-blooded murder. Skip over to 2 Samuel chapter 4, verse 1. It says, when Ishbosheth, son of Saul, heard that Abner had died in Hebron, he lost courage and all Israel became alarmed. See, Abner had been the real leader of the northern kingdom. Ishbosheth was a puppet king, and everyone knew it. Now that Abner was dead, what would they do? Everyone in the northern kingdom was feeling uncertain, frightened. There was a danger that the whole kingdom would come unraveled. It seems like there's always someone, though, who feels that they have license to step in and solve the problem for everyone. You probably have people like that at work, people in the neighborhood. Well, in this case, it's two brothers who had been serving as leaders in Ishbosheth's army. They decided they were going to solve the problem for everyone. They snuck into the house of Ishbosheth while he was taking a nap, and they stabbed him to death. They then cut his head off and then traveled all night to bring the head of Ishbosheth to David in Hebron. Verse 8 says, they brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron and said to the king, here is the head of Ishbosheth, son of Saul, your enemy who tried to kill you. This day the Lord has avenged my lord the king against Saul and his offspring. They think, oh, David's going to be happy for what we've done. David answered Rechab and his brother Baana, the sons of Rimmon, the Beriathites, as surely as the Lord lives, who has delivered me out of every trouble, when someone told me Saul is dead and thought he was bringing good news, I seized him and put him to death in Ziklag. That was the reward I gave him for his news. How much more when wicked men have killed an innocent man in his own house and on his own bed? Should I not now demand his blood from your hand and rid the earth of you? Uh-oh. So David gave an order to his men, and they killed them. They cut off their hands and feet and hung the bodies by the pool in Hebron. But they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in Abner's tomb in Hebron. A lesson in this perhaps might be that one should not presume to know what the Lord or the king wants. Mistakes can be fatal. David, he had no ill will towards Saul or anyone in his family. David got no pleasure from the death of Saul. He got no pleasure from the death of Saul's son Ishbosheth, even though it could be argued that in both cases, they were people who were standing in the way of the fulfillment of God's promise to David to become king. See, David chose to wait for the Lord. He would trust the Lord to fulfill his promise to David. He would not make it happen his own way or leverage for his own advantage the wicked acts of others. We need to trust the Lord to do things the way he wants them done when he wants them done. This idea of waiting is so counter to what we're taught in our culture. In our culture, we're told, make it happen. Seize the opportunity when it presents itself. But we've seen David pass up what appeared to be golden opportunities again and again, choosing instead to wait for the Lord to lead him. In Psalm 37:7, David wrote this. He said, be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. Do not fret when people succeed in their ways, when they carry out their wicked schemes. Psalm 130, verse 5, wait for the Lord. My whole being waits, and in his word I put my hope. Peter, in his letter, 1 Peter 5, 6, he said, humble yourselves, therefore, under God's mighty hand, that he may lift you up in due time. There's a humility in waiting for the Lord, a recognition of who's really in control of our life. When we choose to wait for the Lord, we're choosing his way over our own way. Waiting is trusting him, going in his direction, according to his timing, doing it his way. Waiting for the Lord is not inactivity. It's actively submitting to his lordship, doing what he wants us to do, the way he wants us to do it, when he wants us to do it. Waiting for the Lord is following the Lord. Here's an illustration that maybe helps bring this into focus for us. Picture a dog on a leash, walking with its master down the sidewalk. An undisciplined dog is always tugging and pulling on the leash, running off to one side and then the other, sticking its nose into the bushes, getting into things, looking at everything and everywhere but its master. The dog has never learned to let his master lead. We don't want to be that dog. We want to walk with the Lord, our eyes on him, following his lead. That's waiting for the Lord. Verse 1 of 2 Samuel 5, it says, all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, we are your own flesh and blood. In the past, while Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel on their military campaigns. And the Lord said to you, you will shepherd my people Israel, and you will become their ruler. When all the elders of Israel had come to King David at Hebron, the king made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. David was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned 40 years. In Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and in Jerusalem, he reigned over all Israel and Judah, 33 years. It finally has happened. David is now the king over all of the tribes of Israel. The Lord's promise made to David years before has finally been fulfilled. The journey to this point has not always been smooth and easy, though. There have been many troubles and trials along the way since that day when David was first brought in from the sheep pasture to be anointed by the prophet Samuel in front of his family and the elders of the town of Bethlehem. But the Lord has been faithful. Psalm 40, verse 1, David wrote this, I waited patiently for the Lord. He turned to me and heard my cry. He lifted me out of the slimy pit, out of the mud and mire. He set my feet on a rock and gave me a firm place to stand. He put a new song in my mouth, a hymn of praise to our God. Many of these stories that we have looked at today are just chaos. As people struggled with one another and with God. But underneath all of that, the Lord, he still accomplished his will. David is now the king over all of Israel. Your life may look like a whole lot of chaos, full of disappointments, pain, confusion, detours, side roads, roadblocks. Trust him. He's not forsaken you. He's not forgotten you. He's not ignoring you. He loves you. Wait for the Lord. I remain confident of this, David said. I will see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait for the Lord. Be strong and take heart and wait for the Lord. Let's bow our heads. Father, waiting can be so difficult for us to do. I pray for each of us here this morning, Lord, that we would wait for you, that we would follow you, Lord, that we would put our attention on you and follow your lead, that we would live step for step with you, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen.